I waited on that.
Good stage presence.
Stage what?
Presence.
You all have presents for me? All the end of the week. Okay. I've really looked forward to this all week because every time I get around this guy, I have a lot of fun. And it's usually because he owes me money. Or I, which one of us owes the other one the most money?
I don't know. What was the talk?
But when you're talking, you're about your classic bluegrass artists and people who know the ropes from the very beginning, back when bluegrass music started, up until the time of bluegrass music getting very commercial and going through the hard times, the good times. This young man knows the entire spectrum of bluegrass music. And if you want to think about a classic bluegrass artist, somebody who's traditional, someone who has the right attitude toward the music, somebody who has the correct approach to the music, then I think maybe you're going to have a pretty good time listening to this man talk today. I first saw him on the Bluefield TV station in Bluefield, West Virginia, 1956, 57, 58, around in there, when he was part of a regular daily program called the RFD Jamboree. And at that time I thought, well, those guys can sing. I really like to hear them sing. I had no idea who they were because I really wasn't involved too much in bluegrass at the time. I was about, well, not much taller than I am right now. I was a very young boy at the time. But today is the day that I get to really grill this guy and find out some things that I've wanted to know for years and years and years. Let's all welcome Melvin Goins to us. Have a seat, Melvin. Hey, see, I got the first word.
You expect anything less.
Melvin, I did have a couple questions to ask you. One was, who was your favorite fiddle player in your group between the years 1975 and 78?
I only had one. His name was Buddy Griffin.
So then, you know, I broke a couple microphones that belonged to you one time, Melvin.
He's good breaking up other people's property when it don't belong to him.
You all gonna
put you out of business so you can't perform this
may,
your show.
This may turn completely the opposite way. You may be grilling me before the day's over with. As I said, Melvin has been in the bluegrass business now since bluegrass started back in the middle 40s and up through the classic era through the 1950s, up until you all know what happened a couple times, sort of destroyed the music. But I told him not to ask anything about Elvis Presley or the Beatles, Melvin.
No, because they like to starve us all to death. Sure glad they found a dust to kill the Beatles. I'm sorry Elvis Presley died because he was the greatest rock and roll singer that ever lived. I love all kinds of music, but bluegrass is my favorite. That's what I make my living at.
Well, Melvin, I've heard you sing You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog before.
I sing it bluegrass style, though.
Melvin, I think everybody would really like to hear from a classic bluegrass artist like yourself. And, of course, Melvin doesn't work by himself. He has a brother named Ray, and they go by the name of the Goins Brothers. And they've been doing this stuff for how many years? 30?
About 32 years professional. Started back in 1951 when we were just trying to, you know, walk and play where we get to play a tune.
Eat some taters.
Sometime we didn't get them. We had to just get them out of other people's patches that didn't belong to us.
I thought so. Well, what was the first time, you remember the first time, the first exposure you ever had to bluegrass music?
I certainly do, buddy. They used to have a two-hour show every day at Farm and Fun Time in Bristol, Virginia, WCYB, and that's back in the early days, 1946, 47, when they used to have the Stanley Brothers there, the late and great Charlie Monroe, Flatten Scruggs, and acts like that. Curly King, he played country music, but the Stanley Brothers and Flatten Scruggs and Charlie Monroe, they all played the old mountain tradition of bluegrass. And we was born on a little small farm back over in Bluefield, West Virginia, Bramah, West Virginia, and I can recall back when, in the summertime when we used to work in the cornfields, we would go in when the first bird cheeped in the morning crack of daylight and work the black dark, but I'd always beg my daddy to let me have 30 minutes. I would take my dinner hour many days, wouldn't eat any dinner, just to get to listen to Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs and the Stanley Brothers to play at Farm and Funtime in Bristol. Because they played the music that I always loved and I always wanted to play. Back then, I didn't know if I'd ever learn to play bluegrass, but I was just a small boy, just big enough to hold a plow on the ground and follow a team of mules plow corn. But I knew there's something about bluegrass that I loved, and that's where I really learned to love bluegrass, because I'd always heard about Flatt and Scruggs, Bill Monroe, and the Standard Brothers, and I knew that that was the true roots of bluegrass. And so that was more or less my trademark. That's who I learned from, and that's how I started back in the 40s, 46 and 47.
You still do it the same way today?
I still do it the same way I started. I ain't gonna never change.
He started paying me 22 hot dogs and 50 cents a week when I worked for him. What made you decide? What was the very thing that made you decide that you wanted to play bluegrass and not do anything else?
Well, I'd always loved the tone of a five-string banjo, and Earl Scruggs, just something stuck to me the first time I ever heard him play a banjo. I never had seen him, but I used to listen to him in Bristol. So they used to have Sunday shows before the festivals ever started, and they used to bring shows in on Sunday to Glenwood Park. That's near Princeton, West Virginia, Sunday shows, and they charged 75 cents admission to get in. So they would advertise on the radio station. So I live 10 miles from this park where that they brought these shows in. So I made up my mind that I was going to go see Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. That's when they first formed the Foggy Mountain Boys back in 1940. I believe it's 47 or 48. I don't remember. Earl Scruggs and Lester Flatt. Mack Wiseman was singing tenor. Jimmy Shoemate and Cedric Rainwater. And I didn't have any car to ride, so I walked through the mountains. It was 5 miles to where you could catch a bus, and it cost 20 cents to ride a bus into Princeton. And I had to make my money go a long ways, and I didn't have much, so I couldn't even afford to stop at a restaurant to buy anything to eat. So my mother, she would pack me a little sack lunch, and I would carry my water or Kool-Aid, what it was, to drink, because I didn't have money to buy soda pop and a nickel a bottle. And so she would fix me a little sack lunch, I call it, and the cakes and stuff like that. And I would go into, I would ride into where I could catch a bus, and it cost 20 cents to go in there to ride the bus. And then, of course, back then it was 75 cents to see them. So I didn't have much, you know. But anyway, I got there just like coming to town, walking to Alabama or Elvis Presley. I got a ringside seat. I got there before anybody got there. Got up on the hill, and I never will forget it. They had a stage built there just out of just a little flat bottom stage. It's built out of this rough lumber, slab lumber, like they saw out of the sawmill. They used one microphone, and they had one old round metal speaker. That's all they sang through in one microphone. And Cousin Ezra Klein, he done all the booking back in those days. He was working a daily show out of Bluefield WHIS, and of course the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers. And of course they would always bring in two groups. Of course Ezra was a local group, worked off the local radio station, and he would bring in Flatt and Scruggs and Stanley Brothers. But anyway, getting back to Flatt and Scruggs, they was one of my idols. I always thought that that those fellas played some of the best bluegrass that ever was played. And to me, Earl Scruggs, he'll go down in history. He's a legend. He's one of the greatest banjo pickers that ever strummed across the banjo. But anyway, I got to watching them, and I never can explain the feeling how I felt when they walked on the stage. I can remember mighty well how they was dressed. Back in those days, they wore this John B. Studson hats, the white shirts, long sleeves, and the big broad ties. And they wore riding pants and leggings. They wore leggings, black legging boots. That's because where they got from, I guess, Bill Monroe, when the bluegrass boys back in the early 40s, that's how they dressed. Just shirt sleeves. And to me, that's just like seeing one of the greatest movie stars in the world walk on stage when those fellas walked out on stage. And I tell you, when Scruggs hit that banjo, as the old saying, every hair on my head stood up like bristles on a dog's back. It just chilled me to the bone. Well, I went back home, and I lived that show day to night. I dreamed about it, and I just thought, well, Lord, I'd love to play music. So I went back home, and the first thing I done, well, I went into the mountains. Me and my brother is 2 years younger than me, Ray, which plays the banjo now. And I told him, I said, we're going to build us a stage. He said, what for? I said, so we can get up on play. So I couldn't even play music that time, but I knew it. So we were so poor that we didn't even have any boards. I went into the woods and took an axe and cut down green poles and split them open and turned the round part down, the bark side to the ground, and used the flat part to stand on. And I took me another little pole about like this here, and I took all the bark off of it. And I took a cream can and took a horseshoe nail, which horseshoe nail is what you put shoes on a horse. I pecked it plumb full of holes. That's what I had for a microphone. So then, my first cousin gave me an old archtop harmony guitar. And then the first banjo that we got, me and Ray worked in a hay fields. We stacked hay and hoed corn for 20 cents an hour. We bought our first banjo. We paid $27.50. No, I'm wrong. Back up. The first banjo we got, I traded four hens and a rooster for it from an old railroad conductor over in Bluefield. And what kind was it? It was an old K. It was an old K with no resonator on the back, like the old time, like Uncle Dave Macon used to play. So yeah. I never will forget when I went in getting back to trading the chickens. I went in. My dad was a coal miner, and they go to bed because they had to get up early, you know. So I went back home, and I asked this old fellow what he would take for the banjo, and he said what he wanted, I believe, $5 or $6. I said, well, I don't have no money. He said, you got any good fat hens? I said, yeah, we got chickens. So I went back in to my dad, and my dad was in the bed, so I woke Dad up, and I got a carbide light back then. That's before they used battery lights in the coal mines. They used carbide for a light to see by to work in the mines, load coal. So I got Dad's carbide light, and I went to the hen house, and I got me a great old big sack where feed comes before we feed cattle out of, you know. So I went up there, and I just went to grabbing chickens. So I wound up getting four hens and an old Dahmer rooster. So here I was going back up that river. I had to walk about 2 miles. Believe me, four big fat hens and a rooster was a load. So I went back to that man's house that night. I wanted that banjo so bad, I was afraid that he would get rid of it, you know. So I asked him, I said, what should I do with these chickens? He said, just stick them on the wash tub in the morning. Old timers, that's the way they used to do this, stick them on the wash tub. So I stuck those four hens and a rooster under that wash tub. And so I brought the banjo back home, and me and Ray both wanted to learn to play the banjo, so I seen right off the reel that Ray was going to learn it quicker than I was, so I didn't figure it was any use us both learning to play the banjo. So like I said, my cousin gave me an old harmony guitar, and Ray, he learned to play the banjo. Well, this began when he learned to play it, so we was still in school. We came in one evening, and my daddy was a horse trader. So he traded a banjo. He didn't have enough money to give boot between the swap of the horse and the mule, so he gave the banjo for money for the boot. So he swapped the banjo off and gave it to this boy. So always we'd come in, we'd always look for a banjo. So we came in, no banjo. And I, just about the time that I walked out on the other porch, I seen this boy going around the mountain riding a mule with his banjo stuck under his arm, the one that I'd give the five chickens for. Well, I was really down broke hearted because there the banjo was gone. So I didn't know what to do. So I wasn't going to be outdone, so I got out and went to another fella's house there, and he worked in the mines. And he was going to put a basement under his house. So I asked him, I said, well, what about letting us dig the dirt out, wheelbar, pick and shovel? So he said, well, go ahead. He said, I'll give you $60 to do it. So 5 days, we dug rocks out of their biggest wheelbar beds. I didn't think it was going to ever get done, but I was wanting to get done on Friday evening because I knew he got a payday on Friday evening. So I got an uncle of mine, the only uncle I have, my mother's brother. He helped us, so three of us. So we got the basement all dug out. So he paid us that evening, gave us $60. Well, me and Ray wouldn't go back home at night because we was afraid Dad would make us take the money and buy school clothes with it because it was a big family. And we didn't want to take no chance, so we slipped off and went to my grandfather's. I was about 17 years old, I guess. So we slipped off and went to my grandfather. He was a railroad man. And so we went into town the next morning, and they had this banjo there at Bluefield Music Store, and it was $27.50. They'd taken it out of the winter, so I thought sure they'd sold it, so I said, we're out again. So I talked to the boy. He said, no, I said, we just got it back in the back doing some repair work on it. So we bought the banjo, and this is the funniest part. I can remember this as long as I live, speaking of the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers. They had a daily radio show there in Bluefield then, WHIS. So we bought the banjo for $27.50, and me and Ray went into Woolworths and bought us a dollar straw hat apiece. We was the biggest things that ever hit Nashville, we thought we were. So we went up to the radio station where our cousin Ezra and the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers was doing they had a 6-day program there. It was on a Saturday. And he said, you boys play one. I said, no, I said, we ain't got time today. I said, we'll come back next week. And neither one of us could play nothing. But we didn't want to tell him that we couldn't play because we didn't want to get embarrassed. So we went on home, and we was worried about going home, afraid Dad would whip us for taking the money and buying the banjo. So Ray said, well, let's see if this banjo's any count. So We walked up to an old alley there where they had an old rooming house. It's where Ezra lived there on Raleigh Street in Bluefield. And we was up in that alley there. Boy, Ray was really getting down on that banjo. And just, he thought he's playing it, but he wasn't. There was a lady that throwed a kettle of scrub water out a window over top and just drowned us in that kettle of water like you mop floors with. Went all over these hats, all over the banjo. Back then, they put hide heads on banjo. If you got it wet, they would burst, you know. Didn't have any plastic heads back in those days. So, boy, way down, we wiped and cleaned that banjo. And those straw hats looked like bonnets after they got wet. Went back down with him. So we went on home. We waited as late as we could to get home because we knew Dad would whip us for buying the banjo. We lived back on an old farm and country house. You couldn't even get a car to it on in the summertime. We always kept a team. We had to ride or walk. My dad had never owned a car as long as we lived. So anyway, we got in about, it was about 6 or 7 o'clock that evening, and my dad was laying out in the yard under a big flower bush in the summertime. I never will forget it, in a straight chair, laying back and resting because he worked in the mines, and then he rested on Saturday. So Ray would always put me in front. If anybody had to take the rap, I always caught the first lick. So I had the banjo behind me. Didn't even have a case. Of course, we couldn't even afford to buy a case for it, no way. So when my daddy heard that chain, we had an old big chain we hooked over the nail to open the gate with. When my daddy heard the chain fall, he raised it and looked, and I'll never forget. He said, "Where are you a bunch of old layout boys been?" I thought, well, this is it. And I still had the banjo behind me, trying to keep him from seeing it. He said, "What you got behind you?" Well, I knew I had to show it. I said, "Daddy," I said, "we bought us a banjo." And I was afraid he was going to get it and maybe just make stove kindling out of it or just tear it all to pieces and whip us for buying it and spending the money. Well, my daddy was an old-time banjo player, and my grandpa was, too, and all my people was old-time banjo players and fiddle players. He said, "Well, let me look at it." I'll never forget it. He counted the brackets on it. The brackets, this thing that holds a head down, and it had 39 brackets on it. Well, he said, "It's a pretty good banjo." He tuned it up, and he played Ellen Smith, old drawhammer style. He played Ellen Smith and sung a little bit of Pretty Polly. And he let us keep the banjo. From then on, we learned to go on, and then Ray learned to play the banjo. He made a pretty good banjo player, and I learned to play the guitar. We just went from place to place, and we'd play a few square dances, and until back in 1951 and 52, then Ray got his first job with the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers and went to work with them when he was 16 years old. Left me at home, and he stayed about a year, and he come back, and then he came back home, and then we started playing, and then 1953, then we rejoined the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers. We both went to work. But before we did this, if I'm taking too long, you tell me.
Well, you got all before the time you need.
Before we did this, I knew we had to get a start. So we went into this town. We didn't have, like I said, we didn't have a car to ride to get nowhere into to play music. If we got anywhere, we had to hitchhike or hobo a ride or just get there however we could, you know. So I got a daily show, Doug Ford. He was a radio announcer, WHIS in Bluefield. So I went in and I talked to him because I'd got acquainted with him back when Ray used to work at the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers back in the 52 before I went to work or so. I went in August of 1953 and I talked him into giving us a 30-minute radio show a day. And we was playing a little dance on Saturday night right out of Princeton. We made about $10 or $12 a week apiece. But then I knew we couldn't make that radio show and try to get back in Fargo every day at 2 o'clock Bluefield. So we got that radio show and boy, we thought we was the biggest things in the world. We got that radio show. And well, I knew we had to get a place to stay. So there's an old hotel there that's set beside of the rest that's tore down and gone now, an old hotel called the Drake Hotel there. So they let us stay there for $6 a week. Well, I knew we'd starve to death because we didn't have enough money to buy food with. So I would go back as far as the home, and the man, if they caught you eating or cooking, they'd throw you out of the old hotel. So I said, well, there's got to be some way out. So I'd go home, and my mother would give me Irish potatoes and green beans and stuff to cook with, and I would put them in a suitcase, then lay clothes over top of them so they'd think it was taking in clothes, wouldn't take anything to eat. And my grandmother gave me a little hot plate, one-out hot plate. So I would go in there, and we would cook and walk back as far as to the radio station, do that radio show day, and we made little old pictures that we sold for 25 cents a piece on the air there. And that's how we kind of used that to get back as far as, you know, and travel around in. But we stayed there till, I guess, that fall of 1953. That's when me and Ray got a job and went to work with the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers in Pikeville, Kentucky. But one morning, I never will forget, the funniest thing happened. I was cooking, and Joe Meadows, a good friend of Buddy's, he's a fiddle player. I told Joe and Ray, I said, "Y'all get the banjo out and fiddle." I said, "Play so they can't hear these eggs and meat frying popping in this grease." So Joe and Ray was playing some old fiddle tunes, banjo tunes, and somebody rapped on the door. I said, boys, don't open that door. I said, they'll go throw us out of here. Well, there I was with some eggs and bacon frying in this grease and had it sitting over in the sink in the corner of this old hotel room. Well, I didn't know what to do, so the first thought come to me, there's an old-fashioned dresser set there with these old big swing dresses, these old mirrors on it, you know. So this come to me, I'll just put that skillet in that dresser drawer. So I just reached, got the hot plate skillet grease and all, and I just put it in that dresser drawer, and I just shoved the drawer back up. So I said, boys, open the door. Well, I raised the window over here. There's a restaurant, Jimmy's restaurant, set right down under us. And these maids come in and said, man, I said, what's burning up in here? I said, I don't know. I said, we had to raise the windows down there. I said, that restaurant, I said, must be something coming out of that restaurant. I looked down between my legs, and the blue smoke just boiling out of that dresser drawer. Hear them eggs? You know how eggs are popping, saying in grease? I thought that's it. But I like to set the dresser for, and I cooked breakfast in the dresser drawer that morning. Well, that's just a few of the things that, wow, when we first started, that's what we went through with.
You were doing a live radio show at that time. How long was the show?
30 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Tell us about that. Tell us something about it.
Did they throw you out of the hotel?
No, they didn't throw us out because we got in with the old porter there, and he was a colored fella, and he loved to fiddle. So he knew what we was doing, so he let us get by with it. But that was the only way is to carry it in a suitcase like you had clothes and cook, because if they had caught us, they would throw us out. But that was the only way we had to survive and to play music and stay there and do that radio show, because we didn't have the money to ride back and forth. We didn't even have a car. And what did you say, buddy?
What did I say? Oh, radio, yeah. I know, I knew what I'd said.
Well, we done the radio show. Our first radio show we ever done, getting back before, I'll go back up. Our first radio show we ever done the man is gone now, passed away, Gordon Jennings. He was working off another radio station in Bluefield, WKOY. And we really wanted to get on the radio. We never had been on radio. This was before we went on WHIS. So I had the old guitar, the old Harmony, archtop that my first cousin gave me, and Race had the $27.50 banjo. So we caught a city bus and went into town, and this radio station was located out near Bluefield, Virginia, out there. It was cold weather, and Ray, I never forget what we had, Ray wrapped a sheepskin coat around the banjo, and my grandmother made me took a feed sack, you know, like feed comes in like you feed cows and horses, a 100-pound feed sack. She made me a thing to put this guitar in and put me an orange drawstring in the top. So I put this guitar down that sack, and here we was going right down to the middle of town, right in the city of Bluefield, with a banjo, the sheepskin coat around, and me with a guitar and a chopped feed sack. So we got into this radio station, and I was so cold that I couldn't even note the guitar. Couldn't get it in tune, had old broke string, had him wired back. So Gordon Jennings, I never will forget it, he had an old Martin guitar there. It was an early 40, way back in 40. He'd had it for years. And I never will forget it. He said, Melvis, why don't you play my guitar? And boy, a Martin guitar is just the same as giving you a Rolls Royce or a Cadillac. Man, I got that guitar and I looked at it, boy, it felt so good, a little small neck and strummed the chord. Boy, it sounded good. So he gave us a 15-minute program there at WKOY in Bluefield. I'll never forget it. I went back home. I told my mother, I said, boy, I said, Mommy, everybody knows us now. I said, we've been on the radio. And it got out probably 25, 30 miles, you know, there. Well, I thought everybody knew us because we'd been on that one radio station, you know. But our biggest break was when I went to work there in Bluefield, WHIS. We worked there from August to November of 1953. And Ezra Klein was working the big barn frolic, WJR, in Michigan. And he was moving to Pikeville, Kentucky, going to work at the radio station there. And Ezra needed a lead singer and a banjo picker. So we was there one night. It was on a Thursday night. I never will forget it. He called us from Logan, West Virginia, and asked us if we'd like to have a job and move to Pikeville, Kentucky, and go to work with the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers. So Joe Meadows was working with us then. And we hated to leave Joe, but Joe had went home at night to Camp Creek. So I told Ray, I said, Ray, I said, well, wintertime's setting in. I said, cold weather's here. And I said, we ain't got no way of getting around. And I said, he offered us a good deal. It was with a professional group, you know, and good money then, about $60, $70 a week. And that was big money back in those days in the 53. So we took the job, and Joe come back the next day, and we told Joe about it. And Joe really was downhearted, you know. So Curtis Ray come by, Joe come by, Ray come by, and Curtis Ray, the fiddle player, come by on Sunday morning, picked us up, and took us to Pikeville, Kentucky, and I had two pair of pants and a pair of penny loafers of $5, all I had to my name left after squared up, and I got homesick. Boy, and we stayed there about 4 or 5 days, and we was ready to leave. But we got acquainted with the people in Eastern Kentucky, and they were so good to us, and man, they were just the greatest people in the world. So we stayed on, and Joe, Carter Stanley, they needed a fiddle player, so Carter called the radio station one day at WLSI in Pikeville, and we got Joe a job working with the Standing Brothers. So it made it good for both of us. We went to work with the Lonesome Pine Fitters, and Ralph Joe Meadows went to work with Cardinal Ralph, the Standing Brothers at WCYB in Bristol.
And at that time, it's kind of, it shows you how everybody moves around in bluegrass music. Art Stamper was working with the Stanleys at that time.
Right. That was just before Art went in to make a hairdresser. Art was 16 years old.
And now Art's working with you.
Yeah.
Joe's working in Washington. And of course, Curly Ray Klein
is with Ralph Stanley.
For their group with Ralph Stanley. So all these musicians move around so much and move around quite a bit.
Well, back then, see, there's no TV. And the way you had to do, say you'd go to this radio station. Say if they had a radio station here in Elkins, West Virginia. Well, you'd work here maybe 5 or 6 months. Well, you'd work this area out because it wasn't enough to play back in those days, but just small schoolhouses and things like that. Well, when you worked out, then you had to move on to another radio station, maybe like up in Virginia or North Carolina. That's the way Flat and Scruggs did in Monroe. They would shift around. They'd go to Roanoke, and they'd work in Raleigh, North Carolina, and they would go maybe in Kentucky. And about 6 months, usually, you worked the area out. And you had to move on because back in those days, you just had to depend on the little schoolhouses and things like that for a living. There wasn't no festivals. There wasn't no TV. There wasn't anything. And back then time, if you made $5 a night, that was big wages. I mean, that's all. If you made $5, that was a big night. That's equal to 100 now back in them days, in the 50s. You could buy a lot for $5. A lot of times I would like to have $5 because I couldn't buy nothing.
did you promote your own shows or did you have a promoter?
I've always done all my promoting. I've never used an agency to do my booking and set my shows up. Even back in the early days when we played the schoolhouses and the drive-in theaters, when we used to work on top of the concession stand, 4 TVs every big. Bugs eat you up.
You couldn't see the ground.
When you got done, you didn't have to worry about supper because you'd already had a supper off the bugs on top of the snack bar.
When did the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers get their break with RCA Records, and when did you record with them?
The Lonesome Pine Fiddlers got their break with RCA Victor Records in 1951. Ray recorded in 52, and my first session I'd done was 1954, 30 years ago, with RCA Victor. Of course, they'd recorded on another label before then, but Ray was 16 years old. Ray recorded his first session with RCA Victor in 1952. That's when he was working out of Bluefield, WHIS Bluefield, West Virginia. He picked the banjo and sung, and Paul Williams, and Curly Ray, and Esri.
What were some of the songs you recorded?
On the first session, they recorded was, You Broke Your Promise, Nobody Cares, Brown Eyed Darling, and 21 Years. That was some of the early numbers, first numbers for RCA Victor.
When did you record Windy Mountain?
Windy Mountain in 1954.
And that was with RCA.
That was RCA Victor.
But no curb service.
No curb service.
These are my two favorites.
Yeah. Well, I done two sessions with RCA 1954 and 55 with the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers.
Somebody asked the other day about a song, He Showed Me the Way. Was that you, Jeff?
Yeah.
He Showed Me the Way. That was put on Starday Records. That was on Starday Records.
Is that the one that goes, He Showed Me the Way? That bass line? Didn't Bill Rawlings record that with y'all later?
No, Bill Rawlings didn't cut that.
Did I? Was that one of the many I was on?
That was one. That was some stuff we'd done for Rebel Records.
I thought it was.
No, not for Rebel, but yeah, for Rebel, right. Back in 1970, 75, and 76.
And we're going to take a little break after a while, and when we come back, have Melvin get his, if you'll honor us with this, get his guitar and sing a couple of those songs that he'd recorded for RCA back then. One more question, and this might take us up to a little break. When those records came out, and I've always wanted to ask you this question. When the records came out, of course, RCA had quite a good distribution. And here you had your own records on the radio all the time. I know they were plastered all over the jukeboxes down through central West Virginia because I lived there.
That's right.
And I heard them. What'd it feel like to hear your records on the radio and hear them on the jukeboxes?
You know, it really made you feel good. I had never recorded a record. And I'll never forget the first time that I went into Nashville to record for RCA Victor Records at the Brown Studio. Steve Scholes was the A&R man, and Chet Atkinson, which is the A&R man, head man of RCA now, was under Steve Scholes. And I'll never forget it. We were supposed to record it on a Monday. And we met Steve Scholes back at the Opry there on Saturday night. And some way they had to change around, somebody else was doing a session, so we had to go in and record on Sunday. And I was scared to death. honest, a country boy. I didn't know what a recorder should look like. And I shook, I tell you, I bet you I drank a half a gallon of water to record a session of records. Back then, four numbers was a session. There wasn't any albums back in those days. There wasn't any 8-track tapes. There wasn't any cassettes. And that's just when they made the switch over from the old 78s to the 45s, a little 45 plastic records. And this Chet Atkins was there, Johnny and Jack, and Eddie Arnold. They had just done two sessions that day, and we had to go right back in and follow them. And you can imagine Eddie Arnold and Johnny and Jack and Chet Atkins sitting in the studio, and you there going to record. But I went through that session of records the quickest of any session I've ever been to. 45 minutes I had it cut. And it's just like a man, you stand on a 1,000-foot cliff, afraid of somebody's going to shove you off if you don't move. And boy, I went and I got the job done. I got it done, got out of there, and I was scared to death.
Any other bands do your all songs at that time? The ones you record? Surely, if they heard them on record, they were singing.
Well, back in those days, there's a lot of the bands done the old songs. I guess the biggest numbers we ever had for Victor was Dirty Dishes Blues, a number that Gene Masters wrote, one of the Masters family, and Brown Eyed Darling. That was two of the biggest numbers we ever had for
Arson. Who wrote that?
Patsy Cline, Ezra's daughter, wrote Brown Eyed Darling. She got the idea of writing Brown Eyed Darling when Bobby Osborne, one of the Osborne brothers that she married, he went into Marines in 1952, I believe. And